don't get to Pittsburgh very often.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Special Committee on Small Business Growth. Today is May 25th, 2016, and what we're going to be doing today are informational meetings, and we've got several clusters before us, all of them related to consumables, and that definition is kind of broad for today's purposes. We're going to start off with the first panel of wine, cider, and malt beverages, and so I'm going to ask if Sam Tannehill, Ben Edmonds, and James Kahn could come on up. And then following that panel, we're going to go to liquor and cannabis. And then following that panel, we're going to go to food. Then following that panel, we're going to, and I may adjust this. Art, what's your timing today? How much time do you have with us today?
Completely up to you.
Do you need to get back on the road back home?
No.
You're okay?
Thank you very much, but it's all yours.
All right. If you let me know if you got to change that and we can rearrange things. And our fourth panel is I've invited Art Hill to come share some thoughts with us about business innovation incubators as it relates to food processing and some of what he's doing. So, all right. Mr. Kocher, are there any thoughts you want to open up with as we start off this panel?
Well, I wanted to welcome our new committee administrator.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And thank our transitioning committee administrator who's being drawn off to another committee.
Right. Right. Jen, do you want to take a moment and just share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I've been working in the legislature for 8 years or so and currently staffing Representative Holby's House Business and Labor Committee and Senator Dembrough's Workforce Committee. So in the past, there was a task force on small business, and I staffed that as well, and Representative Gomberg was on that. So I'm familiar with some of the issues.
Perfect.
Here to help any member.
We're glad you're here. Now, I'd ask for everyone to be a little patient with me. In my 8 terms, I've only served on four policy committees and over 16 years. So I may be a little rusty at running a policy committee. If we're in Ways and Means, I've got it down. But here it's going to be a little rusty. So anyway, why don't we kick off, Sam?
Sure.
Why don't you kick it off, and if you could just introduce yourself for the record and then share your thoughts with us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. My name is Sam Tannehill. I'm the founder and wine grower for A to Z Wine Works, and I'd like to thank both the co-chairs and representatives for having me here and giving me the ability to testify on behalf of my business in the wine industry and food and beverage industry as well. It looks like a fun morning for you all. Sorry I couldn't provide samples, but anyway, that always gets a laugh. So I've got a presentation. Hopefully I'll be relatively coherent. I just got back last night from North Carolina and Georgia selling Oregon wine up there, which there was a big appetite. So a little bit about us. We were established in 2002, myself, my wife, and another couple. We had a 2,500 case production that year, and last year we produced 375,000 cases. We are now the number one selling Oregon brand and wine brand, and we grew 25% last year. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of growth, but it's been great, both for us and the state. Also, in 2014, we became the world's first certified B Corporation Winery, which was pretty great as well. We currently have 5 labels, the bulk of which is A to Z Wine Works. We make Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Gris, Riesling, and Rosé. We have Rex Hill, which is an old winery in Oregon, founded in 1982, which we acquired in 2007. It was a difficult time to acquire a luxury brand, to say the least. We also have Francis Tannehill, William Hatcher, and Rock and Hammer. Those are our brands that we make right now. We currently sell in 50 states and 7 different international markets. We have 64 employees, which we are growing, and we will continue to grow somewhere between 10 to 15% a year. We think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in the United States and certainly a lot of work to be done abroad, which I'll address in a little bit as well. So I was asked to talk about our success and why we've seen such rapid growth. Both I think it's interesting that my winery also mirrors the growth of the Oregon wine industry. When I arrived in 1995, we were the industry was less than half of what it is today, which has been a lot of fun to see. The first is the quality of our wines, and I think that's something that's really goes with the last bullet point as well, and the high perception and reputation for the quality and sustainability of Oregon wines, especially Pinot Noir nationally and to some extent internationally. One of the neat facts that that I found when preparing this presentation, that last year Oregon wines were responsible for 1% of the domestic wine market, and that's all nations. Wines, all domestic wine sold in the United States. However, we produce 20% of the American wines awarded 90 points or higher in the Wine Spectator last year, which is sort of the wine Bible. So that shows that we fight way above our weight as far as quality goes. And that's a really important thing when you think about Oregon agriculture being diverse and small businesses that are making value-added food and wine, that there's a perception that Oregon products are just better, and we're able to take that perception and reality, in fact, and move that into a higher price point that we can maintain for our wines. And I also think, you know, certainly for our success, the culture of innovation and our drive for excellence has been one of the keystones of our success at A2C. So the risks, and as I was driving down here, I realized I forgot the main risk that that sort of overshadows everything, and frankly is climate change. I'm not here to debate whether it's human or otherwise caused, but having each year being the warmest year on record, and this year we're already 7 to 14 days ahead of last year, has presenting in the growing season is presenting some serious challenges. We also, part of that climate change is driving our cost of goods compared to other wine regions around the world. We have very high cost of goods. We have increasingly national and international competition for shelf space among other wine regions. There's limited shelf space on supermarket shelves, and as the world becomes more consolidation, which is in the next point, both in distribution and on and off premise markets, so restaurant chains and supermarket chains, that's going to be a real issue. The average Oregon winery is about 5,000 cases in size, and they're having a really difficult time finding national distribution and getting shelf presence. So I also think there's a challenge of a lack of infrastructure. What I mean by that, we only make about 4 million cases of wine here in Oregon. That pales in comparison to the 250 to 300 million cases that California makes. And so we're just developing the infrastructure to meet the needs for our growth, both in vineyard and fermentation capacity. And then R&D, we have changes in climate change coming up, and we really need to study how our industry is affected by that and how we move around those as well. I also think it's really important to note that as I'm sure you all have heard, that there's going to be a change in private agriculture lands over the next 20 years. 70% of all private ag lands are going to change hands. And as land prices increase, as people move up here and other companies move up here, what does that mean for Oregon? And that could be a challenge, or it could be something that's really good. And I think it's important to research that as we move forward. So I was asked to cite some examples how government, state, or local is helpful to your business. I think the creation of the industry-funded Oregon Wine Board has been extremely helpful to the industry, both in education and research and marketing. The support that we get from ODA, especially in marketing support, has been fantastic as well. It's been a really good partnership with bringing folks here into the state and using some funds there as well. I think funding for OSU and its extension service, especially in light of climate change, has been fantastic, although much more needs to be done. And we're also doing some current work with Business Oregon on the food and beverage roadmap, which I think is going to be really interesting when we see the results of that. So impediment, too many regulatory agencies. If our winery is out in EFU, and so we've got, you know, folks from almost every single regulatory agency, including land use, that we have to deal with. And sometimes it's a, you know, for a winery of our size, it doesn't tend to be that difficult. But for smaller wineries, the amount of paperwork can be extremely daunting. There's not enough funding for a world-class research and development and education network program to support a world-class industry. You know, we've got a world-class industry, and we really need to provide more support, especially to OSU. And then there's a lack of a clear, coordinated marketing and export effort. When I say that, is there's a lot of agencies that are helping the wine industry, but sometimes there's a feeling that they're not all talking. And I say local, state, and federal. So if we can find a way for all those agencies to work together and sort of a clearinghouse, that would be really great, and education for the industry. So change. I think other than more funding for R&D and education, a dedicated food and beverage office that coordinates and develops strategy for food and beverage beverage marketing export efforts, recruits food and beverage talent and businesses to move to Oregon, and eases and streamlines food and beverage regulatory requirements would be fantastic. It would be great. We're in a rapidly changing industry, rapidly growing industry, and it would be great to see some one person or one office that we can relate to. So I wanted also to bring you some fast statistics about Oregon food processing. I know you're going to be looking at these in a little bit, but this is some of the work that we've been working with Eco Northwest and WFPA and a few other folks. The Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, too, shared some numbers with us. So we've got a lot of food processing locations, 114 plants in 23 rural counties, 30 of 114 rural plants in distressed counties, 24,700 direct employees, 14.2 billion total output and value added, and 10 plus sectors for food and beverage. These are adding middle wage food industry opportunities with great middle wages. So if we can grow these, this I think will be really great, especially in rural communities. This is Oregon Food and Beveraging. Hold on 1 second here. I'm not the best with computers. There we go. Oregon Food and Beverage Manufacturing and all over. So if you take a look at the food and beverage manufacturing that we saw, we actually had job growth during the recession when all of the industries dipped down. So this is certainly, in my mind, a horse to bet on in the state. Employment trends. We have food and beverage manufacturing. If you look at Oregon versus the U.S., we're on to something here. So we need to really put the and these are mostly driven by small businesses, and we really need to put the accelerator here, make sure
Let me
maintain.
Let me ask a question there really quick. We look at that trend, how do we find the labor to meet the needs of folks such as yourself?
I think that's a difficult question. You have food and beverage cuts across both rural and urban areas. So I think in the urban areas, we've got a lot of people moving to Oregon and living in urban areas that tend to be very highly educated. So I think that that's actually okay. In the rural areas, it's going to prove to be more difficult, and we really need to find a way to do that.
You know, it's interesting. I represent Morrow County and Umatilla County, and as you pointed out, during the recessionary years, while everyone else was economically struggling, for the most part, my two counties, for the most part, were doing very well. And again, that was their tie to agriculture. But the number one issue, if you talk to any one of those processors, whether it's the folks growing wines in Milton Freewater or potatoes in Hermiston, is they can't find labor.
Yeah.
It's a major, major issue for small business.
I also think they can't find trained labor. And so.
And that's a better way of saying it.
One of the examples that I can cite is in Yamhill, in the high school, the Oregon wine industry is paired with the high school in Yamhill to start a viticulture program to train people that may not end up going to college but are trained in the unique challenges for Oregon viticulture. So I think we really need to start looking at some of those training programs that we can work with in high school.
Thank you.
And I think we see such opportunity on export here. You know, when you look at India and China, this is a graph of the middle class and where they're moving. And I think we'll have something like 3.2 billion middle class consumers in the Pacific Rim by 2050. And Oregon is in a unique position to exploit that market. And I think that not only large business, but a myriad of small businesses in the value added food and beverage world, and in wine. I mean, wine is a perfect medium to sell Oregon. We have a front label and a back label that tells the Oregon story on every single bottle on every single shelf around the world. Once again, this is just sort of hammering home goods that producing industries, food, you know, basically lost no jobs. I like this one. This is, you know, everybody likes to talk about software and how it's growing, but when you look at this, you can see that alcohol employment change from 2007 to 2015 actually met tech software. So that brings me to my next slide of it's 5 o'clock somewhere in the world. Alcohol cluster employment with breweries, wineries, distilleries, beer, wine, alcohol wholesalers are going up in Oregon at a bigger percentage. I think this is something unique. So we started a group called the Oregon Craft Beverage Council with that cut across industry lines of distillers, brewers, and winemakers, and we're able to link together and provide marketing, self-funded marketing efforts, and a little bit of sort of policy information to the members. And it's been a great part. It's been great to be part of that group, and I think it's helping driving the perception of Oregon craft beverages and moving it to a new level. So I talked a little bit about the industry roadmap. This was really born out of the work that I've been doing with Patrick Kreitzer, who's the CEO of Tillamook. We formed a group called the Oregon Food and Beverage Leadership Council and pulled together some more of the larger branded value-added food and beverage producers in Oregon to target these sort of core project objectives. And we were approached by Business Oregon, who said, you know, we'd love to start our first roadmap with y'all. So we raised private funds that were met with funds by Business Oregon. And hopefully at the end of this, we can, you know, focus on five or six key industry subsectors or right in the middle of it and develop strategic initiatives with actionable outcomes with both short and long-term tactics for a 10-year horizon. And we need to create, of course, measures to measure success. So just I know I'm running on long here. Key areas of focus are these three, and these will also be provided for you. And I think down here the Asian market once again, and then the action plan for potential outcomes. Basically, at the end of all of these is to accelerate the food and beverage growth in the state of Oregon. So I know I wandered a little bit from the winery's perspective, but I wanted to give you an idea of what else was going on and other work that we're doing as well. Thank you.
Perfect. Any questions for Sam? Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So I'm happy that it's doing well and that things are great.
Yep.
But I also know that there are some smaller wineries and some folks that maybe haven't diversified their brand as much as you have. And part of the reason why we're here is to find out what you know about why that is.
Sure.
And when you talk about costs compared to other regions, that kind of thing,
yep.
I'd like to hear some more, if I could, a little bit about, I love that it's great, but what else is there?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative, I think that the two main issues that we are seeing is, you know, like every other industry in the United States, there's consolidation out there in the market. And so, once again, if you're an average-sized Oregon winery at 5,000 cases, you're being shut out of distribution. A large distributor, I can't quote me on these numbers, but I think 10 years ago there were 2,000 wine distributors in the United States. There are now 200. The chain restaurant business is switching with the independent restaurants at a rate of 3% a year. So we're losing 3% of you know, small mom and pop restaurant going over to chains. And to get a seat at that table, you know, A to Z, we're just barely at that size to get a seat at that table. So I think the one main challenge that we have is making sure that the smaller wineries or the bulk of the industry has access to market, and that's generally direct to consumer. So mailing lists, being able to ship wines across the United States into other states. We're fortunate as a large winery that we have a compliance department to deal with all the regulations that we have to fill out and all the paperwork we have to fill out to get into every state. So there is, quote-unquote, free shipping across the United States, but it's really difficult to do. Most of the wineries are located in EFU, and they're really dependent on their tasting rooms and events that they hold. So I know there's been some work. I was involved with some work a few years ago to update that, but that also, we really need to take a long, hard look at some land use laws and make sure that that's a, you know, that wineries of smaller size have that access to market and to consumers as well. And then once again, climate change. It might benefit us in the short term, but vineyards are long-term propositions. We plant vineyards to last 100 years. The capital required to plant a vineyard is extraordinary. You know, it's $65,000 an acre for the land, and then another $30,000 on top of that to plant. And then you don't see a return for 5 years after you plant. So if you're planning in Oregon, if you're planning a vineyard for a 100-year time horizon, and all of a sudden we've got temperatures that are increasing, do you have to plant Cabernet and rip out your vineyard and plant Cabernet, which is a big expense? So we need to find ways that we can mitigate those changes that we're seeing. So for me, environmental and then consolidation in the United States are the two really big challenges that we're seeing.
Thank you. Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. And I'm watching the clock. So
I know.
Two quick questions, if I could. First of all, you mentioned the potential market in Asia. And I'd like you to give me 30 seconds on the challenge of getting your product out of Oregon and across the ocean. I'll give you a hint at the answer I expect you'll touch on, Terminal 6.
Terminal 6 is a big issue. Shipping is becoming an issue. Transportation is becoming an issue. But that winds all the way back to getting our grapes to our winery. We source grapes from Ashland to Mosier, and that's becoming an issue. Taxes, tariffs, trade barriers, especially in the market that we all want to go to in China, that I've heard is just they're going to enact a 65% tariff on wines coming from the United States. There's not a level playing field out there, and we're suffering because of that.
Second question, Mr. Co-Chair. give me a minute this time. You mentioned that the greatest potential we have is increased support for either the wine board or for educational institutions, particularly OSU. Give me a snapshot on where we're at and what difference you think that some increases there would make for your industry.
Sure, absolutely. Now, I'm not sure how to do this. Co-chair to co-chair?
Hey, you and him.
Okay. So the wine board. In the wine industry, a lot of times things are based on quality. That's how you open the door. But then there's perception after quality. As I've demonstrated, Oregon wines have a very high perception of quality, and in fact, I believe have a higher quality than most other Pinot Noir producing regions in the world. We need to solidify that reputation. There are people wanting to take that crown from us every single minute, day, 365, whatever euphemism you want to use. And if we were able to provide the wine board with more dollars to market the wine regions, to market Oregon wines, that will help solidify that position, and not even solidify it, but maintain that position. There are people, I can't tell you how many people want to take our place as the one of the premier producers of Pinot Noir in the United States. At OSU, to use an example, because those are the folks that I work with most often in the wine industry, we have world-class researchers doing world-class research for a world-class industry, working in way less than world-class physical institutions. We need to invest in infrastructure, equipment, buildings to give these world-class researchers a home. And the Oregon wine industry, we will never compete on quantity against California. We just can't. We will always compete on quality, and the underlying basis of quality is research, development, and education. And I think public-private partnerships as well. It's a shame that I send most of my analysis for my wines out to a company in California.
Interesting.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thanks so much for the presentation. It's really exciting, interesting information. I was wondering if you have a sense of when the food and beverage roadmap process recommendations will be done, because that'll be a really interesting set of good thinking from people throughout the food and beverage sector on steps that hopefully we as legislators can take maybe in the 2017 session.
Co-Chair, Representative, thank you so much. I'm hoping that we'll have all the work done in the next 3 months.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sam?
James.
James.
Same.
Unless, Sam?
Yeah.
James.
Yes,
you're Ben.
Sam.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Sam.
Yes, thank you.
Ben.
James.
Who would like to speak next?
I'm more than happy. Should I move the microphone?
Please do.
I have a box of tissues here. Thank you for the invitation to be here, co-chair and representative. I represent the cider industry here, which I'm jealous of my partner here to my right, because I wish we had someone doing research in cider, but we have no one doing research.
Excuse me for interrupting, Mr.
And so, just for the record,
yes.
Can you state your name?
Oh, sorry. James Kahn, co-owner of Wandering Angus Cider Works here in Salem,
Perfect,
Oregon.
Perfect, thank you. Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no problem. I'm jealous listening to everything that the wine industry has, because there's no one researching cider, and cider definitely is one of those. We're one of the third wheeled or fifth wheeled kind of partner here in Oregon, but Oregon right now is basically the top market for cider in the country, the number one consumer of cider per capita, and also the most diverse market. When we started, our cidery started in 1999 in Clover, Oregon, by a guy named Roger Mansfield. And he represented a lot of what cider had been in the past, which was a lot of people looking for a different opportunity in their life when they're approaching retirement, and they maybe traveled to Europe. And they saw cider as an opportunity to do something cool, local, grow apples. And a lot of people went to England, and they saw what was happening there in England and France, and they wanted to bring it back. So it's similar to what you get in the wine industry. Mm-hmm. And then the business was purchased by Nick Gunn and Mimi Castile, who Mimi is a family member with Bethel Heights, which is one of the older wineries here in Oregon. They purchased the business in 2004 and moved it from Culver, Oregon to Salem, Oregon, right where Bethel Heights is, up in the Eola Hills. And we've been making cider ever since. Since that time, we had this smaller acre in Culver, Oregon that we're using. It was about 2 acres of apples. Right now, we source apples from 80 acres in Oregon, and that's all organically grown. We have a 12-acre orchard in Ashland. And these are all different associations. Some are contracts, quote-unquote, but they're more relationships with growers. So there's a 12-acre orchard in Ashland. There is about a 2-acre orchard here in Salem, a 50-acre orchard in Hood River, and then we still have the original one in Culver, and also Easy Orchard, which is a grower here in Salem, also grows for us. One of the hard things, though, in cider apples, so it's about 80 acres. In the whole country, there's about 500 acres of dedicated cider apple fruit, so we control a large majority of that. One of the largest growers is actually in New Hampshire, and we grow apples. We purchase apples from him. And he grows apples that are called bittersweets, that are apples that are only used for cider. And those are the rarest of the rare apples that are out there. I'll stick to some of the talking points here. Our main market is the West Coast, and the main market for cider is the West Coast. So a majority of our sales are in Oregon. That's about 40% of our sales. Also, then Southern California, L.A., is our second largest market right now. L.A. represents the largest consumption of cider in the whole country. And then our third best market right now is Seattle. And that represents about 85% of our sales. Back when we were started in 2004 with a new ownership of Wandering Angus Cider Works, there were approximately 5 cider makers in the Northwest. And today there's over 100 between Oregon and Washington. We have an association called the Northwest Cider Association, which represents Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and British Columbia. For our employment, we employ right now 13 full-time employees, and we'll have 3 part-time for summer. Out of that, about half are in the cider making staff, and the other half are in sales and marketing and events. On the cider making staff, to the point of having jobs and people that are well trained, there's no one basically in an industry, if you put a cider job out, there aren't people making cider that have that experience. So people usually rob from other companies. So Angry Orchard, that's the leading cider company right now. They control 70% of the cider market in the U.S. They poach our employees and try to fly them out to places, and luckily they don't take up their job offers. Let's see here. Future expansion and growth plans. Our plans are for sales to fill up the West Coast, principally adding new states, Arizona, Nevada, and then trying to make Northern California work for us, which hasn't worked for about 10 years. In terms of expansion of equipment, we're going to be adding new tanks that we purchased locally from a company called AAA Stainless, and developing our retail presence by getting an expanded tasting room here in Salem. Because the tourism is actually expanding for cider, whereas we have an established wine trail, we have established beer trail, and we're known as that nationally. For cider, that's developing, and we actually have people from around the country coming and visiting Oregon and us as a cider destination. Hmm. 2 or 3 most important factors of our success I could just put your PowerPoint up, but staying ahead of the innovation curve. So we were the first to kind of split our brands. So we have a brand, Wandering Angus Cider, that's particular to heirloom cider apples, which are, again, are really rare, so they're hard to source, and that's one of our constraints. But then we have another brand called Anthem Cider that uses regular eating apples that we press about 2 days before we ferment, and it allows us to be more like a brewery model, where we're not the winery model is where you're pressing all your grapes at one time at harvest. That's how Wandering Angus is. So we harvest the apples, we press them, we have all this juice that we have to do something with, and we have to ferment in tanks. So it's very capital intensive. Whereas Anthem, we press apples year-round, so it's less capital intensive, more like a brewery. A brewery doesn't purchase all of its water, all its hops, all its grain at one time and say, what do we do all with all this? So we have those two brands, and so we have to stay innovative. And after that, a lot of other cider companies have had two brands. We go into different formats, different approaches, and trying to get different markets for those different formats. For instance, having 12-ounce bottles, kegs, and different packaging material. Also remaining craft-focused. I think that is a key to our success, and I think is a key to a lot of Oregon's success. As I travel around a lot of the country, I was just recently in Chicago, Philadelphia, and L.A., I think 2 weeks ago. In the same week, I flew every day. And Oregon has really good credentials in all those markets. And I was part of the Good Foods Mercantile, which is a new kind of association of food producers. And a number of them are Oregon producers. And when you go to Chicago, Oregon beer, it doesn't really saturate there, but Oregon wine has a presence there. People know what that is. There's a category on the shelf for that. It's the same as cider is creating that identity. Cheese has a huge identity across the country with being notarized, especially with Rogue Creamery. And some of the other leading creameries that we have. And also choosing great business partners, and that's one of the keys to our success. Oregon definitely has, because of the wine industry and the brewing industry, we have great manufacturers. Partnering with the right distributors who meet our size, that's one of the, both a success and an impediment, is partnering up with distributors that are the correct size for us. So Columbia Distributing is the largest distributor in the state. We had been with them a couple of years ago, but we basically got lost in their book. We didn't know how to navigate the organization. So finding distributors that are the right size for our size. And that's one of the difficult things when you enter new markets, are finding those key partners to partner with. And also our employees, we do consider them as partners in our business. They're not just employees. The greatest risks to our long-term business success is cider being seen as legitimate and diverse. The growth in cider has basically come from the gluten-free market. That kind of exploded. Also, this idea of craft. So my theory is that the gluten-free folks demanded a gluten-free alternative that was of high quality, that was similar to beer in alcohol level and price point. So they would demand cider. They weren't necessarily the market drinking it, but once they got it in, the craft beer drinker and the craft drinker in general actually saw that diversity, saw legitimate choices, so they started drinking it. And that's kind of where we got that momentum going. But that's one of the risks, is that it's seen not as legitimate as gluten-free kind of falls off. And also being seen as a peer with wine and beer, so that you see in a grocery store, instead of just wine and beer, you see wine, beer, and cider. And right now, Fred Meyer, they're having challenges with that because they changed their sets before they changed their signage. So we're in the malternative sign, malt beverages, which we are not. And then also large producers that are not craft focused entering the game and establishing cider as both cheap and sweet, which it is not necessarily cheap and sweet. Some examples that government has helped us: the city of Salem was immensely pivotal in our growth because they funded our expansion in 2011 with some urban renewal funds that they had in the Fairview District, which were very huge, and it was a loan through a jobs program. And they funded us about $250,000, which we improved our building and also bought equipment with, which was really innovative. Usually you can't buy equipment, but that equipment has to stay within that urban growth area. It can't leave, so we're kind of trapped there.
I'm going to ask you if you could just take about two more minutes.
Sure.
And then I'm going to have to move to the next speaker.
Yeah, no problem. Also, Department of Ag has helped with international, and then our enterprise zone with some of the property tax abatement has been really helpful. OSU has been supportive. They have a cider program, and also PSU has a brewing program where they've integrated cider. And some impediments similar to what was brought up before, the OLCC, just clarifying their rules and regulations. They're very confused by them, so I think having some clarification on them would be helpful. And then streamlining the reporting requirements so that we understand what we have to report, when, and also maybe doing it electronically. And then also working on similar trade missions, both domestically and internationally, and helping to get support with those. The Department of Agriculture, we're doing some stuff with Japan right now, and there's an Oregon Cider Week in Japan, which is exciting. And then some of the most critical, I think, promoting, again, Brand Oregon. Sounds like we're working on this together. But a Brand Oregon, and actually a diversifying that in terms of the a Cider Oregon, or a brand that is Cider Oregon focused, both internationally and domestically. So not only focusing on Asia, but New York City, Texas, Chicago, and different areas like that. And also funding more cider and research, both for orchards and for the production.
Got it. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? You talked about the reporting process. It's paper form currently?
It is paper form, yes. Yes.
Very burdensome. If we could get that electronic, that would help. I see three heads nodding.
Yeah, and to address that, co-chair and representatives, is the you basically have to submit every single invoice to OLCC. And to be able to show that what was sold in-state and what was sold out-of-state, and which can be a lot if you have a lot of out-of-state invoices.
So do you think if this committee asked the OLCC to sit down and convene a small work group with folks such as yourself to streamline that process, do you think collectively in a room you could come up with a better system?
I would assume so.
I hope
our,
so.
The better system, whether we'll do it or not. Yeah.
But I assume we could, yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting. It depends on who you talk to at the OLCC. Mm-hmm. And making sure. And that's one of the confusing things is, depending who you talk to, you'll get different answers. So.
Let me ask one more question, and then we'll move on. Does the OLCC have any type of small business ombudsman to help you as you're working through processes?
So thanks for the question there, co-chair and representatives. I've worked a lot. So we recently passed what's called the Cider Act, and both Representative Blumenauer and Senator Wyden worked on that on the federal side, and it clarifies the excise tax, which was really large, and the federal regulating body is the TTB, Tax and Trade Bureau. And for years, we've had an audit from them, and it was a big deal a couple of years ago. But they do have an ombudsman and a liaison, and she's been wonderful to work with. And I have not identified that person within the OLCC. But I think having someone like that can be a contact that could help us navigate that would be very, very helpful.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Welcome. You can just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Ben Edmonds. I'm the brewmaster at Breakside Brewery and also a member of the Oregon Brewers Guild. So thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg-Smith and representatives, for inviting me to speak today. I'm going to read from a prepared statement.
Perfect.
Otherwise, I'm not as good off the cuff. I'm honored to represent both Breakside and Oregon Small Brewers before the committee today. Breakside was started in May of 2010, established initially as a small brew pub in Northeast Portland's Woodlawn neighborhood. At that time, we produced about 1,000 kegs of beer per year, all of which were sold right over the bar at our pub. 2.5 years later, at the beginning of 2013, we expanded to a 15,000 square foot space, industrial space, where we built a production brewery. And in 2013, when we started rolling beer out of that second location, we jumped from producing about 500 barrels of beer per year, so barrels, 2 kegs of beer, to about 3,500. In 2014 and 15, we doubled in size again each year, selling 7,500 barrels and then 14,500 barrels each year, respectively. And what basically started as a small glorified restaurant with a pub brewery in its basement is now a business that sells over 14,000 pints per day throughout our wide-ranging network of wholesalers, grocers, retailers, and that's across 9 states and 5 different countries. That's done by a team of 25 people on the brewing side, including shipping, business, and office support. Our original restaurant is still open and employs a staff of 30 between the front of house and kitchen. Later this summer, we'll be opening a new pub and brewery in Northwest Portland, and there'll be 50 new jobs created between the front of house and kitchen right there. I can also proudly say that we have a pretty near-perfect retention rate amongst our employees, especially on the brewery side, where we offer staff a living wage, robust benefits package, 3 weeks vacation paid, 2-week family leave, dental, vision, life insurance, professional development opportunities, and more. We've really only had one employee or brewer leave our company since we started. And oddly enough, he gave up a job in brewing to become a lobbyist here in Salem. I'm still not sure why either. He's actually in the room right now, too. On the brewery and manufacturing side, our current site allows us to grow from our current size of 25,000 barrels per year to upwards of 37,000, which we hope to reach in 2018. And 80% of the beer that we still produce, despite the fact that we sell beer in a wide range of different, you know, states and countries at this point, 80% is still sold and consumed in Oregon. Yeah. And I think that our story with our growth is not an anomaly within the Oregon craft beer industry. If you need only look at the stories of breweries like Ninkasi and Eugene, at Hop Valley, also in Eugene, Barley Brown's out in Baker City, Freem Family Brewers in Hood River, Good Life, Boneyard in Bend, Fort George in Astoria, Pelican in Tillamook, to see that Oregon's a great place to be in the beer business. Even in just the first 3 months of 2016, the OLCC reported 13 new breweries opening in Oregon, a rate of 1 new brewery per week in the state right now. So why has the craft beer business in Oregon been so good? I think there are a few reasons, but I'll point to the fact that more than any other state, Oregon, home to the first brew pub law in the country, has enacted forward-thinking legislation that minimizes the hurdles to opening a brewery and selling beer. The craft brewers in the state, the wholesalers, have worked closely together, recognizing that everyone in the supply chain benefits if breweries grow. We're also one of the few states where a brewery can get a single license and sell beer at retail, distribute widely via a wholesaler, self-distribute, sell other people's beer in their own locations, apply for special events licenses, and sell packaged beer in a wide variety of containers and formats all from one location. And those ideas at this point in our industry are so commonplace and so widely accepted, not just by brewers, but by the wholesale side of it as well, our wholesale partners as well, that it seems really almost implausible to think that in other states brewers face hurdles and protracted battles with their own wholesalers about things like whether they can sell a growler at retail or not. But that still happens. So Oregon craft brewers have grown thanks to the friendly legislative and regulatory environment. We see it personally at the local level as well. The city of Milwaukee asked us to design a sampling port to monitor brewery effluent. So we work closely with the Water Department, Bureau of Environmental Services, and the mayor himself to come up with a solution that was cost-effective, environmentally responsible, and suitable to all the parties involved. You don't often hear craft brewers raving about the state liquor boards, but it's a well-known fact that, for lack of a better word, the OLCC rocks. They are responsive, in our experience, about clarifying rules, updating practices, and responsibly promoting state beer. The Portland area permitter, a woman named Deborah Tenenholtz, is such a pleasure to work with. One of our local breweries named a beer after her. Gigantic Brewing made a beer called St. Tenenholtz Dry Hopped Pale. So given all this, There's very little that I, either on behalf of Breakside or Oregon small brewers, am in want of, but there are a couple issues, long-term issues, that craft brewers face. I just would plant the seed out and echo what's been said already here. First, as our industry grows, we need more skilled workers. Our need for more skilled workers will grow. And I'd love to see investment in university or trade school training programs that can train and prepare students for a career in the beer industry. And just to go off my script here for a second on this, I think that one thing that's particularly challenging about this is that you have a mix of very sophisticated training programs in fermentation science that prepare people to be at executive or mid-management levels in these types of enterprises. Most small brewers do not need people at that pay rate or that level of experience. They want people who are have a little bit of training. So it's some sort of introduction to manufacturing, not necessarily brewery specific, but that could be applicable to a wide range of food and beverage industries. Also, craft brewers have always been better at making beer than selling beer, and insofar as possible, I'd urge the state to help promote the entire Oregon craft food and beverage sector for the sake of tourism, export, and investment. Again, the food and beverage office that focuses on those kind of three elements, tourism and promotion for export as well and for long-term investment. Second, and this is probably the change I've been asked to underscore by most of the small breweries in the state, I'd like to recommend that tax reporting, payment, and bonding to the OLCC be changed to mirror what's done at the federal level. Right now, brewers file monthly privileged tax reports, as do winemakers and cider makers. Last month, 30 of the smallest breweries in the state had to file reports and write checks for less than $30. At the federal level, brewers who owe less than $1,000 in excise tax annually only have to pay once annually. That would, at the state level, that would obviously relieve brewers from a certain paperwork burden. And I did the number here. I think it's about 18 breweries would only pay once a year. So that would reduce, for those smallest 18 breweries in the state, that liability. They also have no bond requirement at the federal level. For brewers who are kind of in that next tier up that are owing somewhere between $1,000 and $50,000 to the federal government each year in excise taxes, those are done as quarterly payments. And again, there's no bond requirement for that, and I could see a system being easily transitioned to the state level as well. And that would still leave the largest 17 brewers in the state, who make up the vast majority of the beer sold in the state and thus the majority of the privileged tax collected by the state, still paying on a monthly basis. And on a related note, I'd ask the committee to urge the OLCC to modernize the reporting system so that those reports can be filed online. Of all the states and federal governments and federal government agencies that I interact with on behalf of Breakside, Oregon is only one of two that does not have an e-file option for excise taxes. The other is British Columbia. And finally, I'd ask that the committee consider a revision to HB 3125, which was passed last October, which allows a five-year tax exemption on newly acquired machinery and equipment. Breweries, as well as wineries and any alcohol producer, are not allowed to partake in that tax exemption. But the ability to defer those tax liabilities, particularly in capital-heavy industries where you have to buy new tanks on a regular basis, will allow producers to invest in additional capital projects and jobs. Thank you all for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
All right. Please go have a seat. We're going to ask if Ted Pappas and Eric Schumacher could come on up. And colleagues, I've done a poor job of managing the clock. And so I have six people left to speak today and 67 minutes. So what I'm going to do is ask each one of our speakers to be prepared to give their presentation within about 7 minutes and to allow 3 minutes for questions, if that would be all right. So 7 minutes to speak, 3 minutes for questions. Welcome.
We've never met before, obviously. I want to thank the wine guy for sucking up all of our time. Expect a case delivered tomorrow. My name is Ted Pappas. I am the owner of Big Bottom Distilling and the president of the Oregon Distillers Guild. Thank you very much for allowing us to be here and practice my art of fast talking. The one thing I say to people that are starting a distillery, one, you must love paperwork, and two, you're ready to work for a nonprofit. It takes anywhere from 12 to potentially 24 months from the ordering of a still to actually be in production. We also have products. The king of product is whiskey, which requires aging. So it's a long time sometimes to get product to market. And when you're playing in the gin and vodka space, it's very competitive. The big brands dominate, and you have to go on a low price. So we face a lot of challenges. What I think is very interesting is no one mentioned taxes up here a little bit earlier. And I kind of want to picture that Pac-Man diagram on the OLCC website where that green part that's about to munch down on everybody else, that's spirits. That's us. So we are providing majority of the funds that come into the state through all the alcohols. We also pay the highest FET, which we're trying to get reduced. So when you come into this business, you're working for a nonprofit for a period of time, you love paperwork, you know you're the heaviest tax, both state and federal. Why do you do it? Well, passion. And I give a lot of that credit to the beer and wine guys before us and gals who really laid down that passionate road path for us to follow. Number-wise, we're at 74 distilled spirit permits in the state. You might think that's pretty good. It's not. We used to be number two. We are now number eight, and the problem is we are actually getting we're getting taken up. North Carolina is going to pass us pretty soon. Kentucky almost passed us last month, but we had four new distilleries actually get their permits approved. They're right on our heels behind us by three. This isn't a good trend. We should be up there. Washington came out of nowhere and kicked our butts. It's the only way to put it. Which was kind of disheartening considering they have a lot of other laws in there that you think would prevent distilleries from opening, but lo and behold, it actually forced them to explode. So I keep an eye on that. I think we have the right opportunity to do that. We've done things, for example, in the past that allows us to sell product at farmers markets, at events, which a lot of states still can't do. We have tasting rooms. We don't have a limited number of bottles we can sell. We can charge for samples. We have a good relationship with the OLCC. So there's things in Oregon that I really can't figure out why you don't want to come here. Why don't you want to set up shop in Oregon? Why would you pick another state to do it? So one of the things that's been mentioned a couple of times is property tax, personal property tax in our businesses that go along with it. And I read over the one for the food processing and kind of looked at it and said, well, there might be a smarter way to do it for distilling. And it would really be look at the base equipment that you have to start a distillery. It's mash tun, still, and at least two fermentation tanks. Those four pieces of equipment. I'm not going to try to add on gaskets and clamps and hoses and pumps and all that. Let's be really clear. It's those four pieces of equipment. Why? Because if I know I'm going to get some kind of tax exemption, is what I'm shooting for, out of that piece of equipment, that's going to encourage me to get a bigger still. You get a bigger still, you get bigger tanks. Two tanks aren't enough to do it. You need more if you're running a five-day operation. Those tanks will now be bigger. We can produce more. We can put more in storage. We can put more in bottle when it's time to come. Now, in order to do that, we need capital. So the tax exemption could potentially help that not only with the equipment but to grow our business. Some of the common themes you heard, and I'll touch on those before I start getting the eyeball. I like the idea of looking for the job training. There really isn't a lot of distilling activities to do, and we don't necessarily want to poach the other industries. Habits are different. A brewer that makes beer might not be the right person to do my mash. So it is a little bit more specific with us. Again, not to bring up the state to the north, but they actually are starting to do some programs and actually building centers of excellence up there to do this kind of training. We would like to see it, obviously, in our own backyard. So I think that's a big one. Brand Oregon is huge. We're getting there in the spirits world. When I go to conventions and represent Oregon, there was a time 5 years ago when honestly we were on a pedestal because we are right behind California, and everyone knew that per the number of craft distilleries, we were probably actually ahead of them because of the number of winery DSPs down there. But now it's kind of changing. People are paying attention to New York. People are paying attention to Colorado. I don't really like that. So having that brand Oregon back out there, no matter what mechanism it comes through, even though we did try to pass a spirits board in the last session that didn't fly, something like that around all of the libations in the state would be really good and help us out. And it would raise the spirits, wine, beer, cider, cannabis, everything in the state, which is kind of what we want. But those are, I skipped through all my stuff, and I won't go into too much anything else because I want to allow time for questions.
Any questions from the committee? Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for being here today. Personal property tax, those four pieces of equipment, what does that typically cost a startup operation?
Co-chairs, representatives, it depends. If you're going in for about 100 gallon still, which is a relatively small one, you can go anywhere between 30 and 50K on that still. You can go a little bit cheaper. Your tanks on average are running anywhere between 4,000 to 5,000. Your mash tun's probably running you about 10. So that's one of the issues, is even if we were in the food processing one, we'd be below 100,000. Mm. With that setup, you actually can do a pretty good amount of booze. I know, because that's what I run. So I think that, but I wanted a 250. But I knew the implications to getting that 250, and next thing you know it, I'd be in a bigger, higher tax bracket. So
thanks.
Have folks in your industry heard from Business Oregon and the Enterprise Zone programs that allow you to be eligible for a property tax exemption?
Chair and representatives, yes. Majority of them have, but that is kind of on my – I get calls about every couple weeks, hey, I want to start a distillery. You know, and I do talk about the Enterprise Zone. The problem is, at least in my hood in Hillsboro, the Enterprise Zone is an area that's just, it's not workable for me. It doesn't make sense to put it there. In Portland, the area kind of does make sense because especially where Clear Creek is and further back. But then you're dealing with the city of Portland, which, not to go down a rat hole or anything, is a little bit of a challenge to work with. I'm glad I'm in Hillsboro.
Oh, hold my commentary. Okay.
Yeah, we'll keep that.
Simple. All right. Any other questions?
So, if I could.
Yes, please.
How long is this industry? I mean, to be honest with you, I didn't realize how large it's become. But how long has it been? I mean, where did it start? And how to get to this point?
Well, it really, you know, I got to give credit to two different organizations. One of them's HRD because they were actually the first distilled spirits plant in the state, and then second would be Steve McCarthy with Clear Creek. I look to him as kind of the godfather of distilling in the state. Then there was a period in the 2000s era where we started doing a lot of vodka. And we got on the map for being this vodka production, and that was the beginning of craft here in the state. As we've actually grown and matured, we're now looking more towards our backyard for all of our raw materials and making something that makes sense from Oregon. Single malts specifically are going to be coming out in Oregon, so you're going to hear about that. We're trying to do things to get that on the map. All of our brandies that we make and others make all come from fruit within Oregon. So we're really trying to give some kind of regionalized thing there, but that's why promotion and brand Oregon is important, so people like yourself know that they can stock their bar with Oregon products.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Welcome, sir. You can just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Eric Shoemaker.
Perfect.
I'm here as one of the co-founders of the Swell Companies, which is a vertically integrated craft cannabis company here in the state of Oregon. It's really an honor to be here, especially we see the craft beer, wine, and cider, and specifically spirits as our forebears in many ways, and it's cool to be up here with this group. We are vertically integrated but for retail, so we have production, processing, wholesale, and distribution. We're about 22 FTEs right now and about another 10 sort of part-time. I just learned a pretty cool statistic yesterday. We are the second largest employer in Park Rose, which is sort of North Portland. I got that directly from the Park Rose Neighborhood Business Association. That was really cool. I just want to talk a little bit about kind of my arc into this industry because I think it's interesting. I am primarily a commercial real estate investor. I'm a small R Republican. I describe myself as a Tom McCall Republican. When my wife and I were looking at this industry about 3 years ago, she's much more conservative even than I am. We were intending to be passive investors, providing both startup capital and a couple buildings to a management team that we really believed in. And we have become very much active in this business, and it's been super rewarding on a lot of different levels. The growth that we are experiencing is meteoric. We grew annualized like 550% last year. I don't think we're going to do that this year. But we're in about 180 dispensaries out of the 370 or so that I think are actually operating. We, again, do, and I don't know how familiar the committee is with the industry, but we basically do everything from growing on various farm assets through processing, which is refining, selling flour, selling extracts, selling edibles. We then do wholesale and distribution both for ourselves and for others. I use the analogy that we're kind of a sawmill. People bring us raw product and we make it into OSB or 2x4s or glue lambs or any number of products. We do that both for our own supply chain, so farms that we own ourselves, and then also for people that bring us their product and ask us to do various things with it. We're very much a manufacturing and distribution company. We, I think, do a really good job of paying quite high wages, probably average $25 an hour for sort of our, production people. We have full medical, dental, vision. We have an employee stock ownership plan. We are, as of pretty recently, both partially veteran and woman-owned. We are, in terms of where we're going, we're trying to just continue our growth right now. We've got a farm that is stabilized, large-scale production out, sort of supplemental light deprivation greenhouse operation in Colton, Oregon that we did with a private equity group out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. As our partners, we have another one in Washington County, and we're under contract for a third in Clackamas County, and then we have a couple indoor facilities in Portland. So our real estate footprint is actually pretty substantial just by itself. We going through the list of things, in terms of factors for our continued success, it's all about growth, and supply chain security, and that's entirely what we're focused on. I want to really applaud the job that Oregon has done, both the OHA and the OLCC. I think looking at Colorado and looking at Washington, I think we've done a really, really good job of taking the best and leaving some of the less desirable elements out of those two regulatory structures. We're not quite yet fully under the ambit of the OLCC. We look really forward towards working with the OLCC more closely, but our initial exchanges with them have been really positive. There've been, by nature of this sort of handoff, some challenging components to all of it, but it's been a pretty positive experience thus far. Examples of successful things that I think writ large, Oregon's regulatory environment has done well. Removing the residency requirement was huge. We have, again, partners from Tulsa, Oklahoma. We also have partners from Seattle, Washington. That those would not have been doable deals otherwise. Outside capital is vital. This is a hugely capital-intensive business. Even when you're doing greenhouses, we're talking about, our first farm is $2 million just in greenhouses. It's not small stuff. I think not putting arbitrary limits on the number of licenses that the OLCC is issuing is also really important. I think regulatorily, we have fostered this sense of craft and it's a pretty level playing field. If people want to start a business in this and they want to work really hard, they can. And there are actually some really inspiring stories of people starting with not a lot of capital that have grown pretty significant businesses that are real and meaningful. And I think we're one of those. We haven't taken a dime of outside capital yet. As we're transitioning out of this gray area, I think we've done a pretty good job of that just in terms of managing. I haven't seen a lot of stumbles other than a few just sort of unpredictable kind of administrative law interpretation things within the OHA that I think are just part of the process of a handoff between two agencies, right, OHA to OLCC. Every time we've had a challenge or an issue, we've always had access, and it's always been a really good rapport. So there have certainly been conflicts, but not, you know, ones that we can't get over. And so I think we all have appreciated that level of access engagement. Stuff that is, you know, future impediments. I mean, the big one is still basic financial services. I know you all hear that all the time, and I'm not really talking about kind of just commercial banking. That's actually easy. We've never had a problem with commercial banking. It's all the attendant financial services that are like, you know, there are no SBA loans. There are no just basic commercial debt markets. There's really very limited equipment finance. And I don't think that's something that we as Oregon are going to solve. In fact, it's not. The federal nexus is simply, you know, we're 5 years away from that.
Let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
In regard to that issue, are you finding the Oregon Department of Revenue's process for collection of taxes to be straightforward, to be working, to be simple?
We have thus far. Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah. It's not been it's not been a problem for us.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. What else do I have on my sort of cheat sheet here? Most critical state change, I can't, there's not one that I can really put my finger on, other than I think, looking forward to working with the OLCC further. I think they've done a really good job. I think they, you know, one thing that I guess if I, there's a, this is an uncertain landscape, naturally uncertain. We're not going to get certainty, but we can get, there's a difference between certainty and predictability. I think we can maybe have a little bit more predictability, and that comes from over-communication on both sides. That's one thing that I would like to see more of in terms of when there have been the occasional sort of, you know, stumbles within the OHA-OLCC handoff. It's mostly been about if we were better, and again, this goes both ways, both from the industry and from regulators, if we would just continue to try to over-communicate, I think that would help everybody a lot. I know that we're never going to have certainty, but we can have a little bit more predictability if we try that, make sure that practice every day of over-communicating.
Really appreciate you coming in, sharing your thoughts with us. Is there any questions from the panel? I think we're good.
Cool.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. So we're down to 50 minutes and four speakers. So we gained a few minutes here. I've got an old friend out there. Tom, are you going to come on up?
You asked me to.
Come on up, Tom. And Scott and Chris, if you would join Tom. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Tom, it's been a few years since I've seen you.
Yeah, a little less hair.
Yeah. Me or you?
Me. And you.
And you. That's right. So, Tom, if you could just introduce yourself for the record, and then just, you know, take 10 minutes and just share a little bit about Oregon's business environment.
My name is Tom Flaherty. I, and along with my cousin, Brian Mogg, we own Boardman Foods. But real quick, I just wanted to just say, as representatives, public officials of the state, I appreciate what you do. We may agree or disagree, but I think you play a very vital role. And I think the workload that you put in, my cousin was somewhat involved in politics. Anyway, I appreciate the role you do and what you do for the state. Speaking of the state's been very important to our company, Boardman Foods. To give you a little history, my cousin and I were Oregonians. We grew up in the state. My grandparents homesteaded here over in the eastern part of the state. If you're familiar with Burns and Vail, Oregon, they homesteaded there about 100 years ago. And My cousins today still ranch the same land that my grandfather did and his brothers. So Oregon's been a very important part of our lives. When we graduated from college, my partner, cousin, he went a direction. He's an accountant with Arthur Andersen. I headed to Chicago. I was in marketing. And somewhere along the line, we decided that we were going to get into business together. So we convinced our wives that we were going to leave our jobs. And, you know, I had a nice job in Chicago. He had a good job with Arthur Andersen. And we were going to start a company in Oregon. Let's call it Onions. Why? I don't know. We didn't know anything about onions. We didn't know anything about food processing. But we convinced our wives, and we also convinced some other people. We convinced a, I guess you call them a one percenter, to loan us a lot of money. We convinced our family members, my mom, my aunt and uncle, Brian's folks, my brother's and sisters, to loan us a lot of money. We also convinced the state of Oregon to give us $250,000. And we had to make a lot of promises to get that money. The one percenter, we had to give him a return, plus if we didn't give the money back at some point, he was going to own a big piece of us. My family, we had to just give them a return. In the state of Oregon, we had to convince them we were going to do 33 jobs. And so we jumped into business 25 years ago, and I will tell you the first 10 years were very difficult. We got into a pretty big hole. Greg knows how big a hole we got into. And I'm here to tell you, it's tough to owe money to your family when you're in a pretty big hole. I'm just saying. But in any event, we learned a lot, and I'm here to tell you 25 years later, we have paid off all our family. We're good with the port. We buy about 250 million pounds of onions from primarily Oregon. We actually pay for those onions and give the grower the return. And for the state of Oregon, what we gave them was, instead of 33 jobs, now we're closer to 200 jobs and about 45% are family wage jobs. So I don't know if you would call this a success story. I don't feel very successful. I did put my three kids through college. My partner put his four kids through college. But what we learned in this journey, if you will, particularly the last 15 years, the reason we went over to Eastern Oregon, and specifically the Boardman, Oregon, Port of Morrow area, was because of the natural resources that area had. And we are very blessed in this state in relation to, in our case, onions, or whether it's potatoes or corn or a lot of the natural resources that area has. And also the opportunity in what the ports, and ports plural, but also the Port of Morrow specifically in our case, has done to help nurture and utilize those resources that are there with infrastructure, providing power and steam. And all that has allowed us to be competitive. Because if there's one challenge that we've had, we compete. We compete with people in other states. We compete with other countries. When I started business, and to give you just real quick what we do with an onion, we take an onion and we either just clean it up, size it, and ship it to the East Coast, to Japan, wherever. Or if it's got a blemish, we take the peel off, and we sell it to a salsa company, a Frito-Lay, and they'll put it in Tostitos salsa. Or we might chop it, cook it, and send it to Ragu spaghetti sauce, or somebody that is going to put it in a can. Campbell's soup we supply. So we can offer the grower kind of the best use. We use everything, and we can give him a viable return on his crop. And the resources at the port have allowed us to be competitive in a very competitive marketplace. But the challenge that we're having now and the environment that was created some 25 years ago when we got into business, that's changed. It's more difficult. And I don't know if today, as good a salesman as we think we were back then, I don't know if we convince some investors that Oregon would be the right home. I mean, and this is hard for me to say this, because I'm an Oregonian. I've got a lot of family history here. My mom still lives in Ontario. I went to school here. I mean, the environment has shifted. So as we look for the future and what it's going to be viable, we have to remain competitive. And the theme that I've heard ever since I walked in this room was a competitive workforce. Rural America is desperate for, I mean, we need electricians. We need people to run plants. We need people, QA people. We need skilled labor. And it's the biggest challenge. There's plenty of resources. We've got growers. We've got access. We could probably talk a little more about more access to land and more access to water. But the reality is there's resources that are there. But to convert those resources to create markets for outside of the state of Oregon, we need a skilled labor. And we've been very involved as a company. Debbie Rady, our VP of Operations, who was one of the first people that we hired 24 years ago, she's been very involved in Blue Mountain Community College, the workforce training programs, bringing in speakers, working with national food processors. Ironically, she's the chairperson-elect for the Northwest Food Processors. Because she knows for her to run a plant the way she needs, and it's very competitive, we have to have a labor force that succeeds. So that's what we need. And there's already some great programs out there that we've been able to take advantage of that the state has done. I'm not here to talk about. There's good stuff going on. The SHARP program that OSHA, the SHARP Safety, Health, and Achievement Recognition Program, has been a great opportunity for our company to become a safer company. We're one of the only food companies that has the SHARP designation or the SHARP award. I think there's a huge opportunity out there with helping us understand from the state. Now I'm talking about helping us understand the new Food Modernization and Safety Act, FSMA. That's right now, if you're not familiar, there's a very major recall going on in our industry by a processor up in Pasco. This is having huge ramifications for frozen vegetables and potentially fruit. The FDA is coming down very hard on food processors, and there's a lot of unknowns out there, and I think the state can provide an opportunity to help educate all of us, because there's so many unknowns, and the FDA has been such a moving target. So in hindsight, I guess in summary, if I look at the culture that was created 25 years ago for us to start a company and provide jobs in the state, I think that culture has changed. And I think for us to succeed, if you want growth and you want jobs in this state, I think the landscape, because we're competing with other states, we're competing with Idaho, we're competing with Washington, different wage structures. And it's a challenge.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Appreciate your comments. Are there any questions for Tom? Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. You can stay there if you want, or if you need to scoot, you can.
No, I'd like to listen. I want to learn. I learned more about wine and beer in the last 20 minutes.
Welcome.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I just learned about onions. So.
Right. Well, that's a whole other presentation, and that I know.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith and the committee for having me. My name is Scott Laney, and my company is called Hannah and Ryan. We do two things. We make industrial rubber products. We employ about 125 people in Oregon at our corporate headquarters and a manufacturing facility in Eugene. We have another 400 or so people in the Midwest. We compete against China. That's more than a seven-minute story, so I'd like to talk about the other thing I do, our company does, and we grow and distribute proteins direct to chef. Primarily in Portland, we have agricultural land in Wasco County, and in Clackamas County, we farm about 2,400 acres. We grow malting barley, with our partner Rogue Ales, a Newport-based company you might be familiar with. And we run the only floor malt in North America on our ranch in Wasco County, and we floor malt about 2.5 million pounds of malting barley a year for Rogue. So if you drink the right kind of Rogue beers, you're drinking beer from our ranch, which we're very proud of. Those are all kind of envelope-pushing things that Oregon agriculture has shown over and over that we are capable of doing. We're helped, and I will stay within my 7 minutes. Co-Chair Smith.
You have Wasco County. You've got two extra minutes.
we are helped by the state of Oregon government in a number of ways. It's common themes that you've heard today, primarily Oregon State University and the Oregon Department of Agriculture, which inspects portions of our distribution and farming activities. We really appreciate our ODA inspector. Unlike Ben, who testified earlier, we've never considered naming one of our mama cows for him. But now that it's been brought up, we can do that. I feel that ODA, I'm not speaking in any way for ODA, but just as a customer, I think they're a little underfunded, and hopefully that will be rectified. I'm sure every constituency you have feels that way, but they are. I'm here. My ask is simple. We have a USDA constraint. My proteins, pork, beef, poultry, have to be USDA inspected to sell to a chef. We have about 75 restaurant customers in Portland, in the Portland metro area. All of our customers are very small businesses struggling with a lot of things right now, minimum wage and family leave and, you know, little businesses that are learning how to be bigger, hopefully. USDA has programs in place that allow me to do value-added product. So I can take, instead of selling a top round for $3.40 to a chef, I could make it into a roast beef that I can sell for maybe $7.20 a pound. So value-added. The problem is USDA is very, very stretched with the number of international food companies that want to sell food in the U.S. So to get a USDA inspector, you can build the facility, but to get the inspector is almost impossible. There is a little wrinkle in USDA regulations that allow states certain amounts of latitude in how they approach food, how they approach proteins. There's a part of the USDA Act that was generated, I believe, in the early 30s that allows states to do some state inspection. There are even state meat inspection programs that some states use. Pretty expensive. It seems reasonable that we could exploit the smaller thing for slaughter, value add, and additional processing. So the animal has to be slaughtered, it has to be cut up, and it has to be made into something that's sellable. Those three areas. ODA has explored this in the past. They didn't find a lot of appetite for it, and being frank with ODA, which I was earlier, in my estimation, they asked the wrong people. They asked rural, exempt, wild game and pasture cattle processors whether they had interest in this, and they said no, because none of their customers are selling like we do. This is a facility that needs to be built in the urban areas, the metro area somewhere. It will attract customers. I know that as a fact. It will attract a couple of dozen good processors, but they're going to need some funding to take a flyer on that. So, you know, my ask is, can whatever that funding looks like, can we do a pilot, one, two, or three, preferably three-year project, that allows ODA to take a leap of faith in people like me, small-time Oregonian ag producers that want to pursue a more localized market. Can we get a roast beef that I can sell to a store with an Oregon stamp on it? Because we have a lot, you know, we, just like the brewers and the wine guys, I imagine everybody else, there's a lot of faux locality in the meat business. It looks like it's a local product. It's packaged like it's a local product, but it's not. The fake green products like that are hard for us. Made in Oregon eliminates that. And you know, then, that that's from somebody here that has a farm you can go and visit, and you can name the chickens if you want to, or whatever you need to do to have confidence that that's a product you're supporting a local farmer. So that's what I'm here for, and that's what I would appreciate any consideration you can give.
Thank you. So we've got the director of ODA in the audience, Katie. Is that something you folks should just take a look at and let us know the opportunities and the challenges that go with that concept? That would be awesome. Thank you. Any questions, comments?
Oh, great. Thank you. Thanks for this opportunity. My name is Chris Sarles, and I am President and CEO of Oregon Fruit Products. And what's been great today is to hear kind of the interwoven story here between wine, beer, spirits, the growth of malt, et cetera. You'll hear another connection here as I tell a bit of a story. We're a family-owned business, and we've been on the same site here in West Salem for 81 years. We are the second family to own the business. The original family, the Gaylor family, owned it from 1935 to 2011. And then the Miletus family, another Oregon family here, wanted to keep the business local, and so they chose to buy since there was no succession plan left in the Gaylor family. So today, our business is a business in transition. We're also a business in transition as it relates to looking for a new facility to build. So at this time, you know, all of this conversation about what's going on in with rules and regs and taxes, et cetera, it's just very, very appropriate timing to be sitting here and talking about that. Our business breaks down into four areas. We've produced this iconic black can that Oregon across the label that most people have made a cherry pie at some time, and their grandmother made a cherry pie as well. And that was really the original 100% of the business. And over time, we've worked to diversify. Today, we do business with roughly 1,000 breweries across the country, mm-hmm. and we provide all the fruit for brewing. Everyone from a Miller Coors on the, you know, the large side down to your local McMenamin's pub. We also provide fruit into the ingredient world, where we would do business with restaurants, bars, et cetera, where they might make milkshakes or they might be making a salad dressing, et cetera. And then in addition, we have an export business. We do business in 15 countries. And that business has continued to go and grow nicely over the last few years. We employ, call it 80 people every day. It balloons up to about 250 people during the summer. Yesterday was the first day of strawberries coming in. Great to see the fresh fruit and to see the influx of people and new employees that'll be there until September or so. And with that, interestingly enough, you know, our employees that are full-time employees, you know, we pay roughly $1,800 a month in health care mm-hmm. for that employee, and we charge the employees $100 a month. So it's a significant, and it's an absolutely incredibly strong plan. And as I look at all this, it's sort of a zero-sum game in terms of business. The Federal Reserve can create money, but nobody else really can. We in business have a certain amount that we generate through our operations, and at the end of the day, it can only go so many places. And right now, it feels like it is coming at us in every direction. And Tom talked about the FSMA and the amount of time we're spending now just trying to make sure that we're compliant is incredible. Instead of working on selling more and investing more in the business, we're trying to just make sure we don't do something wrong. It's, you know, the criminalization of the food industry is quite scary as someone in our roles today. And, you know, as I think about that zero-sum game, if taxes, if regulations, if whatever that is comes at us, and if we're paying X for employees, you know, we're sort of left with no choice. If we're not generating significantly more income, how are we going to pay for those things? So it's maybe a reduction in health care so that we can pay more taxes. And just a few years ago, you know, we were talking about the importance of a great health care plan for every employee, and we did it. And now it feels a little bit like now we're needing to turn around and address new areas as well. Business is difficult. It has not been easy, and it only feels like it's getting harder with every day. Some of the things that I guess we haven't talked about that people get credit for, when I look at the Department of Ag, I'm impressed with what they do to help us, whether it's foreign the trade missions that generate business. That's been terrific for us, as well as the Food Innovation Center. Mm-hmm. Innovation is the lifeblood of the food business, and if you're not changing and growing and diversifying, you're probably dying. And so we give a lot of credit for what's happening down there as well. Also, CTEC, and the there's some work to in that public-private sector that is helping create qualified employees moving forward. You know, we're, like everyone here that's spoken today, we need a good labor force, and right now it feels like our labor force is either not qualified or moving to another state. And we need to do things to attract and retain college graduates and good workforce. Those 80 jobs that we have, we like to say, are family wage jobs, and we would like to keep that. We're at a crossroads in that as we're looking to take a 1935 plant, and I would welcome anyone at any time to come over and see our dear old plant. It's been cobbled together for 81 years, and we need to move. And the question, like Tom said, is, do you choose to stay in Oregon? I am 51 years old, and I've lived here 50 years, so I'm not quite a native. But with that, I have every desire to keep the business here. The family does as well. But it just doesn't feel like there's too many things being done to make us want and need to stay. So at the end of the day, my ask is, to look at things like the minimum wage that we just put in place and see if there's some things that we can do to have credits built into it while we continue to develop and train employees to become long-term and sort of sustainable employees with us. IP 28, I look at that, and although you're not directly accountable in that, I look at that and think about how that trickles through the food chain. And it isn't just a large company tax. It's going to affect all of us at all levels. And as I said, when you think about what we talked about, all of us are doing business with one another here. And as that trickles through, it has the potential to have a significant impact on the business. Transportation package, that's been in the works and not done. I would just urge everyone to continue to work on that and bring that to a close and to have a seat at the table. I think any and all of us would ask, we'd like to be a part so that you can continue to hear the voice of the businesses and these small businesses that make up Oregon. There's only so many Nike, Intels, et cetera, and the rest of us are out there really trying to kick and scratch and crawl to make a long-term sustainable company that has good family wage jobs. I think lastly, when we look at the that table, sometimes it's easy to get invited a little too late into the process, and it's really something's done and we're looking for someone to sort of bless it. Mm-hmm. My ask is that as you look at some of these things, if folks can be drawn into the committees early, listen to the voice, and we understand no one's going to say yes to whatever's said, but at least take the input, because our desire would be to build another facility here in Oregon and look back and celebrate our 162nd anniversary and not just our 81st.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing those thoughts.
You bet.
Any questions or comments from the panel? From colleagues? Would you like to ask us questions? We're not going there. But the three of you, do you have any final thoughts? Thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Art, Mr. Hill, my good friend from Pendleton. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being patient as I trip through chairing this committee.
As the others have said, I've learned a great deal. Everything from vodka to onions. My name is Art Hill, and I'm from Pendleton. I'd like to thank very much co-chair Smith for inviting me to present today, and Representative Gomberg and the rest of the committee for what we're going to talk about today, and that's the Eastern Oregon Business Innovation Network. This is an idea that I put forth about 2 years ago, and wanted a little bit of history on it. The first people that we approached about interest in it was the Portland State University Business Accelerator. Angela Jackson there is both an angel investor in small businesses and the director of that organization. What immediately became apparent was that in the state there are 30 incubators and accelerators, over 30 actually, and you've heard stories today about how difficult that first few stages of development are for any aspiring business owner. Of the 30 incubators and accelerators in the state, there's not one east of Hood River. And so we viewed that as a challenge and as a problem that we had to solve. And one of the things we did early on was form a core team. I'm a retired vice president from Blue Mountain Community College. I'm now in just private business, my owner, myself. And we brought together a group of people who are passionate about this acceleration idea for small business because primarily in rural Oregon, the small business is the only business. You don't have large corporations, and you're well familiar with this. But I think one of the most important things to remember is that it has consequences. And if you don't have the support and you don't have the resources and you don't have access to the networks that we sometimes take for granted on I-5, then you have capital flight. You have flight of existing businesses across the border into other states. You have flight of youth from your rural communities who see no opportunities for jobs, careers, or futures in those communities. Market access, very difficult, even when you consider beyond transportation, getting your goods to and from your facility. How do you get your people to and from your facility? Some of the housing challenges we have. So we can't address all of these things, but we can address significant ones like bringing resources to the area that can help to grow some of the access to the resources that we need. The people who form businesses, as you heard the word passion today several times. They have the passion. We have the resources, and what our objective is to help them be successful. What could they do with front desk, shared conference rooms, shared labs, shared shops? And we heard a little bit about wine, about spirits, about beer today. We're going to talk specifically about centers that we have in mind to create for these types of businesses. But these are some of the resources that people take for granted who have access to accelerators and networks, but we simply don't have in some rural areas of the state. Mentors, financial advisors, these are few and far between. And we have in this a nexus, kind of a what's there to attract this kind of talent and these kind of resources. Your investor community, almost invisible. When I was in Spokane, we attracted investors from the west side to invest in Spokane companies with huge success. And we'd like to replicate that in Eastern Oregon. Characteristics of investors are that they invest locally. So generally speaking, you're going to have to incubate your own investment community as you do your own entrepreneur community. And you have to create an ecosystem of network of investors, enterprises, and the support systems they need. I had kind of fun with this graphic because I thought of Judge Grasty in Burns, and any of us who've dealt with Judge Grasty knows he's passionate about what's in it for me in Burns. And I wanted to point out that if you were locating a business in Burns, part of the function of the rural incubator would be to make you accessible to world markets, both within the state and beyond. So a little bit about local place-bound innovation has to do with clusters and industry clusters that are important to that location. So, for example, the first sites for the accelerator that we have planned are Pendleton with technology, where an approved unmanned aerial systems range. And there is already testing going on by companies like Pacific Northwest National Labs. There's an ag research company and one project called Future Farm, and this will integrate ground sensors, aerial sensors, and some of the work that's being done in unmanned aerial systems to make our ag producers competitive. So you take these clusters, you identify the local community's need for the resources, and then you build them with a single administration for multiple centers, shared programming, we'll talk briefly about the accelerated learning channel, and then local centers of excellence. The three centers, Pendleton, focused again, as I said, on unmanned aerial systems and agriculture, and then Milton Freewater on the wine, spirits, and the three industries exactly you heard about today. And then Baker City with small farm incubation and value-added food product manufacturing. That's just initially. Then the learning channel is available to all centers. The learning channel is a 24/7, 365 web-enabled live and recorded video channel that means you don't have to create the content for each one of these centers each time. You leverage the work that's been done not only throughout our accelerator but also at other accelerators in the state. And right now we have contracts in process with Angel Capital Association, the Angel Research Institute, with the Oregon Entrepreneurs Network, with Oregon Technology Business Center, and with the Emerging Tech Center for content to distribute through the accelerator. It's been a successful proof of concept. We've done this virtual learning already. We've done it through our small business development centers, for example. And then we have floor plans. We have centers on the drawing board for all three focus industries: aerospace, winery, winemaking, and by the way, that would be available also for other related industries and services, and then finally small farm and food product innovation. So we have testimonials from the folks who have expressed interest. We have publicity already rolling for some of the projects that have been done, and really all of the folks who have been participating in these projects, from winemakers to aerospace companies, have all said, oh, you've got an accelerator? That is fantastic. We need that, because we need that cluster of workforce skills and of business owner skills around our industry. So hopefully we'll be addressing that, and our partners' growing list every day. I have to keep updating this list right now. This is a sample of some of the ones who've expressed interest. And the Federal Economic Development Agency has approved our preliminary proposal and asked us for a full proposal. So we're looking for match facilities and interest on the part of the business community in participating. So we talked a little bit about the problems to solve. We talked a little bit about the biggest challenges. What we're really out after is a sort of an approach that will enable us to create collaboration, state, federal, local, private sector, public sector, and build this to bring those resources to Eastern Oregon. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to inform the committee.
Perfect. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair, and thank you very much for being with us today and for your long trip in, and I hope you have a good, safe trip back.
Thank you.
Help us understand, if you will, the distinctions or the possible duplication between your accelerator and SBDCs and the work they're doing.
Okay. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Smith, appreciate that, and the committee members. The work of the SBDCs, and I'm a retired SBDC director after 14 years, so I know pretty well what they do, they are focused on counseling and advising business owners, on giving them technical assistance in doing business plans, feasibility studies, helping them with the technical details of getting that business up and running, and of growing the business also. A lot of mature businesses as well, going to the next stage. So this would be one of the resources that the accelerator would have available to businesses. There's a partnership already between the small business development centers statewide and our accelerator. And that partnership describes very specifically those things that the SBDC does well. And one of the ways that we are leveraging that investment that the state has made in SBDCs is to give those entrepreneurs an environment in which they can use those technical assistance resources and help them grow even further. So close collaboration, it's definitely one of the key resource partners.
14 years in SBDC?
Yes, sir.
And retired from that. Did you find anybody decent to replace you out there?
More than decent. I was very happy to be. My successor is Carol Frink, who did work advisor to me.
I was making a reference.
I'm in a different region. I have Eastern Oregon University.
I missed it by that much.
Just 50 miles.
But we did work very closely together.
That's right.
And still do.
That's right. Wonderful. Yeah, Representative Blythe, please.
Thank you, co-chair. So how are you funding this? I understand the plans and direction going, but I'm trying to understand, so what's financially, how is it keeping it going at this point?
Co-chairs, Representative Lively, committee. First of all, the application for the federal grant is a 50% match.
That's what I wanted.
So that's seed funding. Mm-hmm. You know, practically speaking, that's seed funding. So we're using the models of the International Business Incubator Association, INBIA, to build a revenue model that includes sustainable revenue sources, for example, the tenant leases.
Sure.
And by the way, in some models, the tenants are in and gone. You force them out after some period of time. We're looking at facilities in each of these cases where we can manage that, and hopefully if a company does grow and could remain there, then they could become an anchor tenant of that same facility. And that would also facilitate networking. So the funding is already being put in by cities. We have $10,000 just recently from the city of Milton Freewater, who is enabling us to get an architect for the floor plans. Cities, counties, private sector. We have not defined any state contribution yet. We did apply for that small governor's grant, but that went a different direction. And we will be actively seeking the funding that will match that EDA grant.
I just, from me personally, I applaud what you're doing. When the efforts were started in Eugene, Springfield, and I wasn't in the legislature when they started, and there was some seed capital provided by the state, which was very nice.
Yes.
But it's turned into a longer-term investment.
Yes.
But my question last time was, so how are we going to make sure the same thing can happen? So how are we going to take what we're learning and this money out there? So I appreciate that you're starting that, and I'm one of those here that supports. It makes great sense.
Thank you.
And the state needs to be a partner, so I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll have a clearer definition as time goes on of our multiple revenue streams.
Yeah.
We're building the financial model for the federal proposal right now.
Right now. Good for you.
You know, I would hope, committee, you know, part of our task is we're charged with figuring out how do we help small business growth in the state of Oregon. And what Art's bringing forward to us, or Mr. Hill's bringing forward to us, is one of those tools that we could utilize statewide.
Yes.
That would help small business. And so, Art, I hope you'll stay in touch with us, stay in touch with me on this, and let's try and figure out how do we further that collaboration.
Co-chairs, committee members, thank you very much. I appreciate that and pleasure to do that.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, look at that. We are 10 minutes early. We pulled it off. Jan wasn't convinced, but we pulled it off. She kept sending me the little sticky notes
saying,
move this thing along. That's her job. She does it well. Mr. Co-Chair, any comments as we wrap up today?
Well, I was just thinking, Mr. Co-Chair, we're going to be getting together probably in late June. We're going to be doing one more series of industry clusters. I believe on our agenda we're going to be talking about bioscience, outdoor recreation, and clothing. Mm-hmm. And then we're also going to be inviting some representatives in from what I loosely term Main Street.
Right.
Downtown small businesses of a variety of types. And after we move through the June meeting, I believe at that point we're going to be start trying to zero not in on clusters, but more on topics. Mm-hmm. And trying to examine some specific opportunities or proposals for those nuggets we keep talking about of potential legislation that we'd like to see this committee pursue for the January-February session.
Perfect. You and I are on the same page. Representative Escobar.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. When we do this, I would like to see if we could possibly get someone from real rural Oregon, example like Lakeview or Burns, mm-hmm. because their concept and their outlook on business is completely different than somebody from Medford or Eugene or Salem. And I would hope that we would be able to reach out and get some people here to give us input, because that's a whole different
great
game
idea.
Out there.
That's a great idea.
Or they could be from Kempner.
Yep, there. That's right. We have a few Ontario. Business owners there. That's right. All righty. Colleagues, is there anything else we want to share today? We really appreciate your participation today, and
Jan, is there anything else we need to think about?
I will. The co-chairs are going to provide some dates for this late June meeting, and then look soon for like a doodle to see when you're available.
Perfect. All righty. See no other business before us. We're going to adjourn.
Thank you.
Adjourn.
Thank you.